weeknights from 6
on 2FM.
To David O'Reilly for driving us through the afternoon. It's Monday, the 28th of October, and you're listening to Game On. Coming up between now and the new music show with Beto Da Silva at 7 p.m, there is big news. Man United have sacked Erik Ten Hag. Miguel Delaney brings us the latest. Plus, Alan Cawley and Stephen Kelly review the rest of the Premier League action, and we look ahead to the final chapter in the League of Ireland title race. In will be Keane Tracy and Stephen Ferris reflect on the weekend's URC action. Plus, it wouldn't be Monday without the rest of our weekend sporting highlights. As always, if you want to have your say, you can send us a text on 51552, WhatsApp us on 087 187 9200, or we're on X at Game On 2FM.
Game On 2FM.
Welcome along. I think the news is too big to leave waiting for our sporting highlights. We will go to the Erik Ten Hag news first. I'm delighted to say that Alan Cawley is with me. Keane Tracy is here as well. And Alan, I'd nearly go as far to say that maybe the Erik Ten Hag news is your weekend sporting highlight.
Well, it's the least surprising news, I have to say, Marie, because we've been saying this for the last number of weeks now, that it's only a matter of time. And after watching the game yesterday, to be fair, the first half, they should have been at least two up. They played half decent in the first half, plenty of chances, and they should have been out of sight, really. But to lose again in the manner that they did to West Ham, who were very, very poor, West Ham struggling themselves. And it's just been, as I said, it's been coming for so long. I'm actually surprised it's gone on this long, Marie, because we could go back through all the weeks where the games, like, they've been so, so poor, and his, I suppose, management would have been called into question on numerous occasions long before this. And yeah, I'm not surprised by it at all. The interesting thing is now, I suppose, who's going to take over?
Yeah, that is. We're going to be chatting to Miguel Delaney very shortly. He's been writing about it all day, so he might have some news on what the process was and who could potentially take his spot. There's plenty of names been thrown in the mix, lots of betting odds and all the rest. So looking forward to chatting to Miguel. Should we may as well park that till we get Miguel on the line. What was your sporting highlight, Keane Tracy?
Well, normally, Marie, when you ask me that question, I do go for rugby, but I'm not going to this time. It wasn't exactly a vintage weekend anyway for the Irish provinces, but I'm going to go for the feel-good stories of the Dublin Marathon yesterday, which, look, there are so many people who run the marathon for brilliant causes, and you just have to tip their hat to them. But I suppose, like, Colin Farrell was the one who was gaining plenty of the headlines and what he did and the money he raised for Deborah Ireland, and finished off the marathon by pushing his friend Emma Fogarty in the wheelchair. I just thought it was incredibly powerful. The image, the video of that, I think you'd want a heart of stone not to be moved by it. And like I said, so many other people are running the marathon for incredible causes. So that was my sporting highlight of the weekend, Marie.
I'm going to go, Marie, for something that I haven't done ever before, and go for the same highlight 2 weeks on the trot. And that was Shelburne. I gave it to last week because the pressure was on and they got the victory against Waterford. And because we're down to such a brilliant nail-biting finish in the league, I was in Talca again on Friday night, and all the pressure on, and the came up trumps and got another victory, and it's brought it, obviously, as we all know now, down to the last game this Friday. And if you go back to the interview after Shelburne lost to Shamrock Rovers, he said, Damien Duff says to Tony afterwards that, if my maths are correct, Tony, if we win three matches, we'll win a league. And they've won two out of the three, Marie, and here we are down to the last one this week.
I have to say, I never doubted them. Now, obviously, they have a game to go, but there's plenty of people, one in this studio, who didn't think that they could do it, but they are.
But they haven't done anything
yet. I know
yet.
They haven't done it yet, but they've done two. Oh, one more to go.
But the two were the ones that were very winnable. This was the one now that's coming up against Derry on Friday, and we'll get into the chat later, but this is the one where I would slightly worry for them, in the sense that I want them to win it now, and the story's amazing. And like Cian said there, even with Damien Duff, such a iconic figure in Irish football. And I was looking at it even on Friday night, Marie, and there's so many kids now going to the matches, and they were all on the pitch because it was the last game of the season as well in Talca Park, and there was such a buzz. I haven't seen it like that in a long time. But a lot of those wouldn't even know how iconic Damien Duff is. This fella is absolutely, like, legendary in terms of...
I've actually tried to tell my kids that he's won two Premier Leagues, and they're like,
and over 100
caps. He's a manager now. Like, they don't see.
Yeah, exactly. And he would have been one of my heroes growing up. So to have him in our league doing what he's doing is absolutely unbelievable. And the passion and the heart and the desire and everything he shows as well. And he's so invested in it. It's amazing.
And so normal and mad as a hatter. Even the
and I love it. I love the madness and the chaos and everything that he brings with it, because he cares so much, Marie. He really cares so much. And if there was more like him in Irish football, I tell you, we'd be in a far better place than where we are. But he is, he's just brilliant, and I hope to get over the line. But the worry I have, it was always going to come down to this one. And when you have Shamrock Rovers breathing down their neck now and they're playing Waterford, do I think they'll beat? I think Shelburne have to go to the Brandywell and beat Derry. I don't think a draw will be
like
enough.
Flip it on its head, Al. It's one game. Like, it's a final. It's an opportunity. I know it's away from home. It's something to Brandywell. Derry are the ones who've been more on the ropes the last few weeks.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And they'll take great heart from the fact that, as you say, Derry have struggled and they've blown their chances. And when you look at the performances they've put in recent weeks, of course Shelburne will go up there fancying their chances. And that's why I think the last two weekends, that being my highlight, is that they've given themselves that chance now. They would have been kicking themselves had they slipped up against a Drogheda or a Waterford. They've done their business in that regard, and now it's down to, he mentioned three cup finals, now it's down to one game, Marie, to win a league. It's unbelievable. And he'll go nuts if they win it.
Oh my God, can you just imagine him? I'm a bit like you, Keane. I love the stories of the regular people, and you get a lot of them, I know, on the marathon. You also get them all around county final days as well. So there was some super results over the weekend. But for me, Doon winning the Limerick Senior Hurling Championship for the first time in their history was the big story of the weekend. It was a horrible day down at the Gaelic grounds. The expectation was all on Napierce, but Doon, they came up trumps. They gave it everything. Adam English, 11 points. But it was just the reaction of the crowd, the players, everything afterwards, and you see it so much, and particularly when you've never done it before and you're kind of coming up against the favourites and the ones that have that winning tradition. So that for me was my sporting highlight, and I just say bring on these county final stories.
I thought you were going to say
Fecal, yeah,
Six Mile Bridge, Marie, there, but you stopped short.
Come on,
what was it, 36 year wait for Fecal? I thought you were going to give it to them there.
Well,
now
I think the opposition now that you mentioned would make me flip that around as well. But yeah, I'm actually delighted for Fecal. My mum is from up around there in Scariff, so it's a huge hurling place. They've produced some brilliant hurlers over the years, but it's a really small place. Like, it's absolutely tiny. It's one of those GA communities, hurling communities, that are backbone by loads of families. Like, you could drive through it and not even realise that you've passed through Fecal, and there's great hurling tradition there, traditional music, all that sort of stuff. And no, I am happy for them, but obviously, like, when it's your own person.
Sometimes I feel sorry for the club player, and I know this, the bigger debate rages on, but sometimes I feel sorry for them when it comes to this time of year, because as you says, the weather and the elements, horrendous.
The whole weekend.
I was in Sligo, and even down there, the weather, and the county final was on in Sligo as well, and it was dread.
The scoreline was really low in it, yeah.
Sort of weather, Marie, you had no chance.
They called off the Westmeath hurling one, yeah. It was difficult.
It was desperate. Like,
no, today was nice. Like, you know.
And
so
I know.
It's
just the chances.
You just don't know.
But this time of year, with the club players playing in all those finals that matter so much to them, and the chances are you're getting a day like that yesterday, it's tough on them.
Yeah, when they win, they don't mind. But when they lose, then they're looking at everything else. Let's get back to that Eric Ten Hag news. Miguel Delaney is with us now on the line. Miguel, I'm not sure. Were you expecting it today?
From some of the stuff overnight, there were more murmurs basically that it was finally going to happen. Now, the caveat to that, of course, is we actually expected this 3 weeks ago when Ineos and the United hierarchy had that 7-hour meeting in the international break. After that, and the only reason they didn't make a decision that day was essentially it was almost classic paralysis by analysis, because they have so many chiefs at the club who all had to put forward their case, and they couldn't come to any sort of meeting. But even then, and even throughout all of the last few weeks, really, they've pretty much known that Ten Hag's time is up, that it's unsustainable. But the other side of that is that they haven't known who could come in his place. But it just got to a point where, regardless of who comes in, and at the moment, It's the former player and current assistant, well, now current interim, Ruud van Nistelrooy, who they just had to do something.
What was the process then like to get to the point where they made a public announcement that Eric Ten Hag was no longer the manager?
Well, I mean, so obviously, through that meeting 3 weeks ago, they'd all made their cases. And again, it was pretty much accepted that that Ten Hag, that this couldn't continue. The one thing throughout all this season, they were prepared to make a decision at some point, but I don't think they prepared for it to get this bad. So once it got to that, it was right up to, or once it got to another result like Sunday, and this on top of Thursday, a one-all at Fenerbahce, which was really a bad form as well, it really went right up to Ratcliffe. From all the word we've had from within the club since over the last few weeks, is that Ratcliffe and also his main consultant, Dave Brailsford, they have been more minded to move Ten Hag on quickly, whereas his other members of the hierarchy who were a bit more reticent. But once it got to that, yeah, it went right up the Ratcliffe. The football people were in full agreement. And, yeah, he's been fairly abruptly, in the end, after a long wait, relieved of his job. As someone put to me today, it's one of those classic situations where it's so slow for so long, and then suddenly it's very quick.
Yeah, as I was saying, Miguel, even to Marie earlier on, we were expecting this on a weekly basis nearly when you're looking at the performances. So I'm surprised it has gone on as long as it has. But even if you look at the past week alone, and two or three things stick out for me just in this week, and you can go back through all, I suppose, his whole tenure and whatever faults that he had and whatever good things he did. But even if you just look at the last week, the Dalo incident against Brentford and the concession of that goal, it was absolutely dreadful. The lack of effort and commitment on his part, and if that's the culture that's at the club, which is obviously there, and zero accountability for mistakes like that, when he came out then against Fenerbahce and he started, and there he was again, Dalo. So there doesn't seem to be any kind of situation or circumstance where no matter what you do or how poorly you pay or how poorly you actually behave in terms of your effort and desire, which is a bare minimum, they were still playing. Then he played Mazraoui as the number 10 against Fenerbahce during the week. Mind-boggling stuff. A fullback that he brings in when you have two attacking players, Ahmad on the bench, and Anthony as well was on the bench before he got injured. So even those two or three things that for me, and the game against Fenerbahce, and Fenerbahce were so poor and the performance was so bad, that I'm just surprised it has gone on, but finally they've come to their senses, I suppose.
Miguel, is it just that he's just not a top class manager?
I think that's part of it. Now, to be fair, at United there is a bigger issue that's actually sort of only getting worse and worse the further they get away from glory, and there's this expectation of everyone that comes in, which is, I mean, like obviously in any job, especially an elite job like that, fundamentally a coach has to be top level. But I think there is another level with United where basically you've got to have the personality and charisma to be able to weather what that job is. I think any young manager, and like say someone like Ciarán McKenna, they should be very wary of stepping into United right now, because no matter how good they are, it does have that potential to just shred someone because of the weight of expectation, because of the scrutiny. And I don't think Ten Hag handled that well. He increasingly got quite, he got quite chippy in media appearances. Now, media appearances, it's a superficial and kind of a small part of the job, but it can still be indicative. And just to take Alan's point there as well, I mean, yeah, I think there was a complete breakdown between the players and the manager in terms of just that chemistry. They were increasingly confused by his decisions. As Alan said as well, just what he was doing, it was like that disciplinarian approach that had initially been welcomed in his first season. It had run out of effect. But also, I think there's something even bigger there as well. I mean, because really, Ineos essentially made this decision before the cup final. Now, for various reasons, they didn't pursue it. One was that they managed to win the cup final. As I've written today, from what I've been told by several people, in the week before the cup final, Ten Hag actually wanted to go toe-to-toe with Manchester City and had to be talked out of by staff around him, thinking that this was the worst way to approach the game. So even in victory, it actually worked against him in some ways. But again, as we saw after that immediately, they essentially interviewed him for his own job while speaking to other people. So even though they persisted with him, it immediately undermined his entire season. How could he expect to have the same authority in the dressing room when they basically knew the club were willing to get rid of him or replace him? And the players also knew that because of that, there was a very good chance if it went wrong this season, they would have had to make this decision every. And this is the thing. They went into the season basically because of what happened in summer. Ten Hag pretty much had to have the team perfect. And as we've seen, they were a long, long, long way off that.
Miguel, what does it say about Ineos, though? Because I think if the Glazers had acted like this, they'd be getting absolutely pilloried by the United supporters. And Ineos are supposed to be the great white hope for a new future. What does it say about them?
Yeah, I mean, they've got really a huge decision now as well. But yeah, I completely agree. I think it hasn't been encouraging. This has been their first big decision. And I think they've handled it badly. It's not just that they've handled it badly once or twice. It feels like it's in this constant stream of indecision, really, and this is a club that needs real certainty. Now, there are obvious caveats there. So when they made the first decision on Ten Hag in June, the CEO, Omar Barada, and the new technical director, Dan Ashworth, weren't in place. But they have been in place since, and it's still left to the same procrastination. And that's why that meeting a few weeks ago is offers potential concern, because it does just feel like there's almost too many voices there that led to this kind of... They just couldn't come to certainty. On the flip side, now I suppose they have a bit of a blank slate. Ashworth is renowned in football as someone who's basically... I mean, the way he's developed his reputation in football is basically by being able to implement technical plans. Essentially, the actual football structure that can make a team work. So if they can do that now, then I suppose there is some encouragement. But, I mean, even in the last few weeks, it feels like they're almost off to, like, they're fighting from the start, because they've seen so many potential candidates, and even candidates who, say, aren't necessarily long-term appointments, but could have been, like, good placeholders, like, say, Thomas Tuchel. Well, they've gone elsewhere. Similar to Mauricio Pochettino. In fact, the 2026 World Cup could be a cast of managers that could have managed Manchester United.
That's what I would be concerned just about. When the new ownership took over, like Ian said, the great white hope, I actually, because I've such respect for Dan Ashworth and the job that he's done and the reputation both at Brighton and England and whatever, I thought this was going to be a really good fresh start for Man United. But as Miguel said, they were so indecisive off the back of the cup final. But I actually felt, Miguel, I'm not sure what you think, the reason for that, which... the only place I have sympathy for Ten Hag was how that was handled leading up to the cup final, because he was totally undermined and it was wrong to be flouting that his job would be lost. Then the beat Man City, they actually played very well in the cup final, if you remember. And I think Ineos were kind of saving face, Miguel, because they were only new in. If they had to act and sack him off the back of winning the cup, there would have been a huge backlash. And I just think they were too indecisive in that moment for that reason. And it's come back to bite them a little bit now. And if they're going to be as indecisive as they were then going forward, I would have a little bit of a worry about them.
But the thing about that is, I mean, the great value was supposed to be like proper, strong leadership and a good, technical team like that. Is that they're supposed to be able to take strong decisions for the future that completely remove emotion. I mean, so one of the phrases at Manchester City, who are their great rivals, and whatever about kind of the bigger issues going on around Manchester City, in a purely football sense, they're seen as the top of the game. And they have a rule there where basically no decisions are made in 24 hours after a match because you take emotion out of it. Whereas at United, as you say, it does feel like they're ultimately influenced by fan emotion, whereas that was precisely the moment to actually ignore that emotion and take the decision that was better for the future of the club, as has now been emphatically proved. Another similar example is actually from a club further down, who used to be considered a model as well. I mean, we mentioned Pochettino a few minutes ago, but I mean, remember when Southampton sacked Atkins in 2013, or Akin, and brought in Pochettino, there was, you know, a furore from the fans, but that dissipated after a few weeks because Pochettino got results. And that's the way these sort of kind of, you know, football hierarchies have to be looking at this.
Stephen Kelly joins us on the line as well. Stephen, what's your reaction to this Erik ten Hag news?
I just think it has come such a long way out. I was kind of disappointed at Ten Hag. They didn't have enough about him just to say stick it to United when they were faffing about in the summer. Genuinely, I would have held him in such higher respects if he had just said, you know what, I'm not taking this, you're looking at other managers, and as much as it's Manchester United and it's a great job, I've gone and won you a trophy and you're indecision behind me and I should have walked. So I think he's left himself, he was only going to end one way, which was him getting the sack. And I think the indecision, which has kind of shocked me, that this whole new group of people and behind the board of United have been so indecisive, missed out on a couple of candidates that would have been probably in their eyes ideal for taking over in Manchester United. And he left himself in a position where they're kind of hoping now that Van Nistelrooy hits the ground when he picks up a few results, and then that will stave it off. And I just don't think that's the model. You know, unless you've seen something in Van Nistelrooy that's exceptional, I don't think you hope that something that comes on in the interim basis like Solskjaer is going to take over and be the answer. So yeah, I just think at the moment, for everything that's gone on in the takeover, I still think the indecision and the kind of just messing about behind the scenes has let them down again.
Miguel, has there been something exceptional seen in Van Nistelrooy?
He is viewed as promising. So even before he took this role, there was talk about him as an up-and-coming coach. Again, I suppose we return to this issue of the leap that a young coach has to make at a club like United. Now, he has been a player there, But obviously being a player is very different to being a manager. The other thing you'd say about that is, well, taking the cynical view, maybe this does point to a bigger plan, given that Ten Hag basically had to lose the coaching staff around him in the summer, while Ineos imposed a new staff, including Van Nistelrooy, around him. It actually it created an issue that would maybe... I mean, Van Nistelrooy obviously usually popular with the fans. He, to be fair, didn't go out and seek a kind of a central role, probably because of awareness, because of all this potential politics. But I suppose in saying that, the flip side you could argue, maybe this is what Ineos are looking at. I'm only speculating here, but I suppose look at the example of Arteta at Arsenal, where the hierarchy saw something in him. He'd never been a manager before. He'd been an assistant at Manchester City. He'd obviously been an Arsenal player. And the hierarchy decided to basically back him through some difficult years, but they decided to weather that. And, I mean, I don't know if Ineos is thinking this way. The fact that they're talking to other managers now would suggest otherwise. But I suppose it's a potential plan in place.
Who are the front runners, though, if you look outside of him?
So I think they... I know they've been looking at Ruben Amorim, who's at Sporting, and he's someone that basically every top club wants. He was seen as pretty close to Liverpool before they went with Arne Slot. He's been highlighted as someone that Manchester City would want if Guardiola does decide to leave this summer. And of course, if there's no other greater issues at City, given the hearing. So Amorim is going to have his options open. And that's one reason, from what I've been told, that he is very reluctant to leave Sporting mid-season, because he wants to, he wants to approach a job on his own terms. And, you know, having the benefit of the summer rather than being dropped into, I suppose, what at the moment United is a basket case. And also, he'll have his pick of roles. Xavi's been mentioned, although from what a lot of people are saying today, that's been exaggerated a little bit, that he's nowhere near as close as other candidates. They still have Thomas Frank at Brentford in mind. There is talk of maybe an outside run at Julian Nagelsmann, given that there has been a link between him and United before. But then, of course, he's got the great temptation of potentially taking what is a good young Germany team to the World Cup in 2026, having already kind of done the hard part of like restoring Germany to respectability at their own Euros this summer. But given all of that, and given there's so many variables, I do just wonder if it is going to end up a case of Van Nistelrooy staying in the role until the end of the season.
Alan, you're a United fan. Who'd you like?
I like Amorim. I have to say, a huge reputation. Whether they'll get him, I'm not so sure, because even as Miguel said about Kieran McKenna and young coaches like that, they would have to be faced with such trepidation if Man United come calling because of what's going on at the moment. And you can easily damage your reputation no matter how good you are in the space of 6 months at a club that's chaotic, really. So I'm not sure if they'll get one of the main ones with the big reputations. The likes of Xavi, who's probably out there, would be keen, I'd say. But it wouldn't surprise me to see Van Nistelrooy, like Miguel said, in the job for another 2 or 3 months.
And Stephen, when you're a manager looking at these players, and actually even Roy Keane had a bit of a go at the players on Instagram earlier as well, saying that in good teams, coaches hold players accountable. In great teams, players hold players accountable. Are these players good enough, do you think, to be able to at least finish the season with a little bit of success, which is like creep near the top four, I suppose, at this stage?
Yeah, the squad is absolutely good enough to be competing for top four football and be a lot more consistent than what they are. I think that's the crux of it. I think if Ineos or anybody else involved in Manchester United thought that they weren't going to be, the manager still have his job, because he'd be thinking that it's down to the squad and not the manager, whereas they obviously feel the squad of players is more than good enough to be pushing whether or not they get to the top four. Teams have taken huge steps to get that direction over the last few seasons. But the consistency level of Man United has just dropped off so much, and I think that's a huge issue. They need a team that's actually going to turn up every week and show the resilience, a style of play, something that the manager's put in place, and I think that's been lacking for them. But I think the interesting thing about Van Nistelrooy is that I had definitely been in a situation before where their manager's been in charge, but then his understudy has been the manager they were looking to take out. I thought it would be Jacques Santini, and Martin Jol was in the background, and Santini almost knew that Jol was there in a position to take over as soon as he slipped up, and that happened quite quick on the season. And that feels like what was done with Van Nistelrooy. He was kept slightly away from, he was involved but kept slightly away. So I think it's Van Nistelrooy. Yeah, I really do.
Okay, we're going to park the Ten Hag chat for just a minute. Miguel, Ballon d'Or tonight, is there a little bit of controversy over who the winner might be?
Well, controversy on Real Madrid side, who they had plans to send 50 people to Paris, and they'd cleared 5 hours under official TV station to celebrate Vinicius as winner. Word started to leak last night that Rodri had won instead. And now, rather than 50 people in Madrid, are sending one, who is kind of the club delegate, Emilio Butragueño, who always he has to kind of put on the public face in these events, which always points to a lot of the politics around the Ballon d'Or. Now, for all Madrid's indignation, I think it's actually this is actually the most debatable Ballon d'Or in years, in the sense that both Vinicius and Rodri have, you know, almost equal competing claims. It's almost the difference between a defining player in Rodri, given how dominant he is as a midfielder, which is obviously such a... I mean, it's one part of the game. And then the other part of the game, which Vinicius represents, which is basically putting the ball in the net in the most decisive manner possible, given that he did score a key goal in the Champions League final, and he has become almost the ultimate big-game player in the amount of match winners he gets. And like both of those are really as strong a claim he can get. But it's Rodri that's won out.
And who would you go for?
I have to say, I was really wavering on this. I mean, I did think it's 50-50.
I'll put you on the spot now.
Yeah, I know. It's honestly, I'm not trying to sit in the fence here, but it's only, honestly, one of those where I couldn't quite decide. I mean, luckily, I don't have a vote in that sense.
I think Vinicius should have got it, to be fair. Even for what he's dealing with in Spain in terms of the racism stuff and all, he gets an awful time, he really does. And he reacts. I know he's lost the head a couple of times, but I think he handles it quite well. And as Miguel said, Champions League final, the decisive goal. And he has stepped up as being that main player now. He's a superstar player. I love Rodri as well and what he brings, but I think Vinicius should have got it.
Stephen Kelly?
Oh, I'm Rodri.
He's a defender.
That's it. I'm a defender. I just like that. I think that Real Madrid, as much as Vinicius has popped up at the right moments, I think they have other players that could potentially have stunned what he did. Whereas I don't think anybody can do what Rodri does at the moment. I just feel he's irreplaceable. I know City are coping without him, but that's going to be a struggle. I think even, I know Spain, he came off a halftime in the final, but at the Euros he was sensational. I just feel his importance and his role in the game is huge, and I think it's nice to see a player that gets it, not just for goal scoring ability. And I know Vinicius is way more than that. He's such a talent, he's so exciting. I get such a hard, I mean, when I'm saying I'm calling Rodri, I'm going like 51-49. it's close. It's not like I'm giving him massively. But I like this. I just like the fact that Rodri's importance and the role he plays. And when he's on the ball, honestly, he's a genius. And the goals he scored over the last few seasons, Champions League winners, I know that wasn't included in this one, but like the importance of the role he's played has been huge.
Miguel, just before we let you go, because I know you're really busy, is Trent Alexander-Arnold going to go to Real Madrid while we're on the topic of Real Madrid?
Well, it feels like we're in the middle of that Madrid campaign right now. It's funny, though, they haven't yet made a massive push for him because such are the politics of Madrid, as we can see with his Ballon d'Or, that they didn't want to aggravate Dani Carvajal, given like he had his own claim for the Ballon d'Or this year. Mm-hmm. But now that he's injured, obviously interest has stepped up that bit more. I still think it's actually, for the moment, more on Alexander-Arnold's side. He basically wants to kind of, you know, he wants to have an international career in that sense, to profile different countries to see what it's like. Or at least that's what he's considering. It's not completely done yet. And he obviously wants a better wage. But for the moment, Madrid actually are thinking about their options. So it's nowhere close to done.
I
don't think they have to push for him. I think he's going there. I think if he's looking at the team he wants to play for the next 6-7 years, Real Madrid offer the most exciting young talent in world football, and there's no other place that I think he goes to apart from there, especially with his passing ability. I just think that's it. In my mind, I think that's a done deal. I know they're probably looking at it and they're probably
He's big buddies with Bellingham as well, so I'm sure he has a say in it. You know, so I would be with Steven. Even looking at it, it was performance yesterday as well. He was very poor. His second goal, he plays a great pass, but he was very poor. And Slot has taken him off three or four times as well this season, nearly every match. And he has Bradley waiting in the wings. So I think out of the three Liverpool ones, who the contract negotiations, he's the favourite to go, I think, Trent.
Yeah.
Okay, Miguel, thank you so much for that. Cheers, we'll be talking to you. Just before we go, I've been told that David Ornstein has tweeted that Manchester United are working on a deal to appoint Ruben Amorim as head coach. Man United are ready to pay $10 million in a release clause. Miguel, what do you think?
Well, I was told that the clause is actually $20 million for a foreign club. So unless they can negotiate that down. I have to say, if they manage it, that is a coup for United.
Yeah, it really is. Okay, I know it was been mooted today that maybe he didn't want to leave a Sporting mid-season, but we'll see. Miguel, thank you so much for all of that. We're going to look back on the Premier League. We've probably been sidetracked by all the Ten Hag news. We didn't even get to speak about Arsenal and Liverpool yesterday. Alan, do you think that Arne Slot will be happy enough with his point, given they were behind twice?
Yeah, I think he will, yeah, because you're going away to one of, obviously, what I think is one of your rivals in terms of, I think Liverpool are in the mix now to win the title. So when you go away like that, as you said, fell behind. I thought Arsenal were very good in the first half, but Liverpool were the better team in the second half, and I just felt Arsenal never killed them off when they were on top. Liverpool in the second half started to stamp their authority on the game without really creating any clear-cut chances, I have to say, Marie. I thought Arsenal were probably feeling, even though Liverpool were the dominant team, they were probably feeling comfortable up until that pass from Trent in to go in and Salah score. So I think overall it was probably a fair result as well. I thought Arsenal were the better team in the first half and Liverpool in the second.
What did you think, Stephen?
Yeah, I honestly think I concur with that. I think that's pretty much it. I think both come away happy enough. I think Arsenal on the back of with the players they are missing, who probably Liverpool, they're not favourites for the league. I see you're going to still be up there, but they've showed the credentials that they're going to be pushing for. So I think with everything they had going on with the defensive frailties they're supposedly were going to have, I think Arsenal would be happy to come away with the draw. And I think Liverpool, now going to the Emirates, was going to be difficult. I think they'll take it based on the first half performance as well. So I think both teams come away spoiled, shared and unscathed to some extent, so they'll be happy with that.
I think what we've seen as well, Marie, to be fair, with Slot, it's been so rosy in the garden for him and winning all the matches, and we haven't really seen him in a situation where they've been behind. I know that they lost against Nottingham Forest, but they've been winning all the games. So that would have been good from his point of view to see the reaction of them falling behind, as you say, to a big rival away from home as well, and to show the spirit and the character, I suppose, to come back. So I think that will be good from his point, and that's what he'll take away from it also.
Yeah, I just didn't think they looked that settled, Al, Liverpool.
In what sense?
Just that they didn't seem to be as comfortable maybe with the changes, Trent playing that a little bit further up. Just didn't think that.
You know who I thought was a loss, and I'd say he didn't play because Curtis Jones was so good last week. I thought Szoboszlai's energy as well. Yeah, in the power and his running power in the midfield as well. And when you think that Arsenal were... Partey was makeshift right full. He actually played really well. Luis Diaz had no impact on the game at all. Got
I've
taken
seen
off.
Arsenal as well targeting that left side. Mm. Like just they just seemed exposed there. And
but Robertson was struggled as well.
And when we look at what Slot's been doing, one of the things that he's been getting credit for is looking more defensively solid, and I just didn't see that yesterday as much.
Yeah, and that, I suppose that's fair, but I think it was down, like Curtis Jones, for all the praise he got last week against Chelsea, didn't get a kick yesterday. Salah was very quiet as well in the whole game. Luis Diaz. So I think Arsenal, they're probably the more disappointed that they didn't win the match, because for those reasons that they kept a lot of the Liverpool top quality players quiet, whereas Liverpool, to have... We're after naming probably four or five there who had off days, and for them to have the off days and still come away with the point, having been down twice, I think he'll be the happier manager out of the two of them.
Yeah, and I guess as well, Stephen, it was his biggest test this season, and while they didn't come away with 3 points, they still came away with something, which he'll be happy enough with.
Yeah, genuinely, I think going away to Arsenal was going to be... Like you've got City and then you've got Arsenal. They're the two toughest fixtures, I would say, in the calendar for Liverpool this season. And they've gone and they've come away even with them on that. So, and you know, Liverpool at home is a different if they get Kelly Fish altogether. So I think Liverpool are fancy their chances. I think, you know what, we can transferring the tide slightly, improving the different areas that we haven't. And like I said, like Alan said, they didn't play as well as you've seen them play. Yes, it was against lesser opposition, but they haven't been able to be as effective in the forward areas, I think, as that they have been. I think as the ball size was right, I think that energy, the way he played, you know, he's missing, and I think he's very creative in that early part of the game. High up, him and McAllister link up really well. McAllister jumps from the middle of the park, leaving Gravenberg to do that covering role. So I think they just weren't as fluid as they had been. So for Liverpool, but to go to Emirates and come away with a point, I think they'd be absolutely delighted with that. And it just keeps them in close distance, because you just don't want to lose ground. Even though it's this early in the season, you don't want to lose ground on City.
City look laboured against Southampton. We're in October now. When do they move through the gears, Al? Is it December, January?
January.
Yeah, it probably is. When it comes to the business end, you'll know it'll be going through the gears. But they were laboured, but they got the job done. And even to go back to Stephen's point earlier, about no Rodri, they're getting away with it at the moment, yeah. Marie. But and whatever about Southampton, I think they'll be relegated. But when it comes up to the big games, and we're on about the business end, and when they play the Arsenals, and they will play Liverpool, and when they get to the Champions League quarterfinals, semi-finals, that's when you'll see the impact of having no Rodri. So they're getting away with it at the moment. But I think for the first time since Guardiola's come in, for those reasons with no Rodri, I think they're vulnerable this year. And that's why I think Arsenal and Liverpool have a great chance once to just hang on their coattails. And the likes of that game yesterday, you're not falling too far behind, giving yourself a mountain to climb. But if they hang on their coattails, I think Man City are vulnerable this year.
Okay, we'll see. We'll see in January. Mm. Isn't that when it is? Stephen, Spurs losing to Crystal Palace. No, it makes sense.
We're
going to
get past that.
No.
I can't. It's Tottenham all over, isn't it? The goal as well. You're going, there's no need to give a goal away like that. There's absolutely no need. And it's so disappointing, because there's something so special there, and they could be so good at times, and they play unbelievable football. Like, you watch them and you think, wow, they can be so electric, so exciting, but then they can give goals away. And I think for every Spurs fan, they kind of thought, you know, we're going to give Palace their first win of the season. I think everybody kind of went into that game going, every chance that could happen with us, because we're capable of that. And I think that's the frustrating part with them, because the Jekyll and Hyde nature of the performances at times is unbelievable. It doesn't mean that they don't play well. They still produce chances. They still produce goal-scoring opportunities. But to go to Palace and then to lose and to give the goal away, the way it was so poor, really poor goal. Like, just defensively, just making super risks, like pass across your goal, the way they play, they're getting caught out and then losing the ball. And you still have another couple of chances to come recover it. So, yeah, the manager was really annoyed. And that's two games that they've done that themselves, Brighton and now Palace, where they could be sitting in such nicer position on the table.
I love an annoyed Ange.
I do too. I'm a big fan of Ange. And I think the challenge that he's been faced with at the moment, Marie, is we all know he wants to play and the way he wants to play, and it's great to watch. But I think he's trying to impose a mentality on fellas who don't have the mentality. Yeah. And he's getting frustrated by... I think he has a strong mentality and he knows what he wants. But I think it has to... Because they're so inconsistent, and for all the great football that they play, but it still boils down to your mentality when it comes to going away to places like Crystal Palace or wherever and eking out a win or whatever you have to do without having to play great. And they let you down. As Stephen said, it's Spurs all over. They just let you down week to week. You know, they might win two looking great and then they lose the following week just when you think you have it cracked. And I think that's where the frustration is coming from him at the moment, because he wants to put that strong mentality into them, but I think that has to come from within at times as well.
Stephen,
I think he's torn as well. I do think he's torn, you see, because he wants them to play that way all the time. And I think he's very reluctant to go, right, listen, be defensively solid for 10 minutes. It never happens. The two fullbacks are up like number 10s and they leave themselves so exposed at times. And you're going, so the manager wants them to play that way. So you're kind of like, but then he expects them to be resolute and defensively solid, and you're kind of going, oh, something, there has to be a medium, happy medium at times in games where you just go, you know what, let's just stay in this game for a little bit and then we can be tactically great, because you've got the numbers, you've got the players going forward. Like, I know Son was missing and he's a catalyst for most teams, they do well, but that there has to be just a little bit of a middle ground where they could just go, where the manager just goes right into this shape for 10 minutes, consolidate for a little bit, but it just never happens. Which makes him so exciting.
Alan, good news for Evan Ferguson back on the scoreboard.
Yeah, it was great, Marie. From our point of view, we always look at it from our point of view with Evan, and he has gone through such a tough period, I suppose, even though he's so young. But it's great to see him back on the score sheet as well and just contributing and back. And he looked fit and sharp as well. He kind of did in the two international games. It looked like he was getting back to some sort of fitness and sharpness because he's missed so much football. And now to see him back contributing as well for Brighton and took his goal really well. So, of course, we're always looking with the Irish tinted glasses. And we've pinned so much on him, sometimes I think unfairly as well, because we probably don't have anyone else. And it's been so long since we've had... a top quality centre forward, or one that maybe can get us a few goals. So I think it's a little bit unfair on him in that regard, and that's why I'm always trying to maybe dampen down the expectation with him as well, because it's so difficult, Marie, for young kids. We often talk about this, for young kids to go away and play at the elite level now in the Premier League nowadays is so hard, because they're just buying fellas from here, there and everywhere, spending a fortune. And the days of, I suppose, the young lads from Ireland going away playing with Man United and Liverpool, they're long gone and we'll never see them again. So it's so difficult, and I always say this to people with Evan, even you look how difficult it is for him at Brighton, not even one of the elite clubs. So to see him get back on the score sheet as well and contributing was great to see.
And while it was great for Evan, there was disappointment, Stephen, for Shadozie Ogbene. It looks like his season could be over. He picked up a suspected Achilles tear, and again, somebody that was really coming into his own and making his mark.
Yeah, really disappointed. I've been through that before myself. An Achilles tear it's horrible. It really is an awful injury. It just comes out of blue as well. There's kind of nothing that builds up to it. Just all of a sudden happens and you feel this pop and you don't know what's going on. And fingers crossed it's a tear, not a rupture. But even either way, it's still a long recovery. You're in a boot for, I was in a boot for 12 weeks, and it's just not a nice thing. It was towards the end of my career. So, but for him, with his pace and everything, you want to just get back to that as quick as he can. And he's getting game time. He's playing. You know, I think he was off it with their two Ireland games. It's the first time I've seen Ogbene not being as effective in an Ireland jersey. Really, that's the first two games I've seen where he's just not had the same impact as games as he normally does. But to see him playing it, which is back in the Premier League, getting game time in what was really exciting game and an exciting team, it's really disappointing. Like I said, we're Irish at home. You're getting one back to a level. And I actually think, for just to jump on the Evan Ferguson thing, I think the two games back-to-back for Ireland were absolutely massive in him getting himself back to some sort of level of fitness, because you just don't get game time in the Premier League, and he wasn't getting it. So to get 265 minutes back to back in close succession was going to do him the world of good. And you could see in his movements. But for Ogbene, it's an awful injury to pick up, and I hope it's not a rupture.
Yeah, big time. While we're on the topic of young players going well, we have to mention Cole Palmer, Alan. And he's such a fan favourite now. My lads are flat out watching TikToks of him.
So I was out here chatting to your young boy and he was telling me all about him and all. He loves Cole Palmer. Who doesn't love Cole Palmer? And he's such a throwback, Marie. That's what I love about him. He just plays like a free spirit. Yeah. And they're all so built nowadays, almost like robots. They're in unbelievable condition, yet you look at him and he's kind of, the jersey's still hanging off him a little bit, and he doesn't look like one of those kind of prototypes that we see nowadays,
and he doesn't take himself too seriously,
and I love it. Absolutely brilliant. But the pass yesterday was absolutely now Neto, in fairness, is lightning quick, and it probably helped him because Neto was the one running onto it, because it looks like the defender will come across and clean Neto out, but he toe pokes it ahead of him because he's so fast. But the pass and that goal, in fairness, and I'm glad you brought up Chelsea as well, because on top of Cole Palmer, I think that manager's had a really good start. I like him, Maresca. They played very well in Anfield last week as well. And that goal they scored, for the pass for Palmer and then the square ball for Neto and Nicholas Jackson puts it in, it was a brilliant goal.
Yeah, they're getting the job done. Cole Palmer, Stephen, I spoke about him a couple of times yesterday as well, but just to see somebody, as we were saying there, just not take himself too seriously. You get to know the personality a bit. Obviously, when he's playing really well, he's going to get away with making TikTok videos of himself singing and dancing and all those mad interviews, and the kids are loving him and he's a brand. But I don't even think he knows that he's a brand or how popular he is. But it is great, isn't it, to have players like him in the league as well?
No, it is. And like I said, all the stuff off the pitch is in tow with the fact that he's actually playing some sensational football. Like His passing range is wonderful, but his vision for the pass, how early he sees it, and then the ability to deliver it. You're talking Kevin De Bruyne and Trent. They're the players that see those passes and play them, that have done them on a regular basis in the Premier League for the last few seasons. And, you know, the way he's playing at the moment and the way he's picking those passes, I was kind of like, will this season, will he have the same impact at Chelsea? Because if the levels of everybody else goes up, does he need to be that superstar that's holding it together, or can he fit into a team that's playing well and still contribute? And now he's still scoring the goals, but the passes with the players running off him, with the ability that he has around him, he's I've seen him live a couple of times, and he just saunters around the pitch. He never seems to break a sweat, but yeah, he's constantly in the right position. He's constantly capable of going past players. He's never phased when he receives the ball, was back to players, and he is. He's just, and again, I will have to put my hand up. I was going, why were they spending that much money on this player? I couldn't understand. Mm-hmm. I thought Chelsea were just throwing money down the toilet again. And he's absolutely sensational.
Yeah, he really is. And he's a great celebration as well. Stephen Kelly, thank you so much for all of that. We're going to take a very quick break, and then we're going to chat League of Ireland with Alan Cawley.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. We are in the midst. We're actually coming to the end of the most exciting title race that I can remember anyway, Al, but I'm really young. You might be able to remember.
Well, I'm the same age as you, so does that mean I'm really young as well?
It is the most exciting though, isn't it?
Oh, it's absolutely unbelievable. It really is, Marie. It's the best that I can remember also. So to have it coming down to the last day now, and the situation that they have, two massive clubs, Shelburne and Shamrock Rovers, big rivals as well, and to have the situation that we have with an iconic figure leading the team as well into battle, if you like, on Friday night, it's just unbelievable. And the whole, I've said this to you a few times, it hasn't been vintage in terms of the quality, but in terms of EastEnders type drama, it's been unbelievable. It really has.
Yeah, and yesterday Rovers got the job done against Dundalk,
and that's all they had to do. But yeah, one player who's come up big in the last few weeks, Dylan Watts, oh my god. And Dylan's a brilliant player, probably doesn't get the plaudits because you have the likes of Jack, Graham Burke, Mandriau, whereas Dylan this year has been their most consistent player. Now I think he did win player of the month, and to be fair to Stephen Bradley, he's praised him a few times and said he has been the best midfielder in the league, and he's been absolutely brilliant. But to come up with the big goals when you need them, when you think of the one last week in Drogheda as well, 85th minute I think it was, Marie, and nil all, and if they had to draw that, they were gone out of the league as well. And he scores a cracker from about 25 yards. Then yesterday, as you say, a difficult match in Dundalk, pitch is dreadful, after coming off the European game during the week as well, and him to pop up with the big goal again and into the second half when it's nil all, he's come up big. He really has, Dylan, in the last few weeks, all season, but now he's coming up with big game changing moments as well. I think they'll win on Friday night, Marie. I really do. I said it to you a few weeks ago, because of the running, they're the ones I think will win the league. But Shelburne, we want to win the league.
You sound like Damien Duff. Everybody wants Shamrock Rovers to win it, or Shelburne. He does a bit of both.
Who? Everyone.
Yeah, the
I think the league fans in general probably, and nothing against Shamrock Rovers, have been a brilliant team, but just for something, I suppose, different and a change. But if Shamrock Rovers win it, good luck to them as well, Marie. And that's the situation that we're in now. It's going to come down to that. They've got their job done in the last few weeks while Shelburne were slipping up, while Derry were slipping up. And that's what's given them, I suppose, the situation that we have on Friday because of those slip ups. But Shelburne have come up big in the last couple of weeks when needed. They just need one more on Friday night. And Derry as well. Now, even though Derry's heads will be down, because I think they've blown the league, they're a bit like what I was saying with Spurs. They let you down. I've said this a few times, they let you down. I never thought they were going to win the league. But they'll be playing for Europe, Marie, because you have a situation now where they could have won the league and now they might not even get into Europe in the top three, because St. Pat's won again the other night. Unbelievable run they've been on. So it's not just the case of Shelburne going up to the Brandywell and thinking Derry have nothing to play for and it might be an easier game. Rory Higgins could be playing for his future as well, and if the cup final the following week, and he'll have players playing for places and European football, so it's going to be a really tough ask for Shelburne. You're probably going to ask me, can they do it?
Call it. Give me one club that's going to win it.
I said Shamrock Rovers the last few weeks because of the running, and I'm just so worried. I want Shelburne to win it, but I'm so worried that I think they might only get a draw up in Derry.
Okay, I'm going to go with Charles. We're going to take a very quick break, but do stay with us because we'll be talking rugby.
Game on 2FM.
With me in studio, it's time to talk URC. A bit of a mixed weekend for the provinces, but let's start with the bad, Keane. Why not? Bank holiday Monday. Things could only get better as the show goes on. But for Munster, I guess the disappointment of coming up short in Durban, 41-24, and the Sharks beating them down there. And Graham Rowntree just saying they're overpowered by the Sharks, really.
Yeah, it wasn't a great shock that Munster lost, but I mean, conceding 41 points, another bonus point defeat, their third in a row, was certainly not part of the plan. Look, I think there's a strong sense of deja vu when it comes to talking about Munster's plight. You look at like how long have you been talking about? They have a lengthy injury list. They are completely depowered in the front row, and you could see that the Sharks went after them. And you know, Munster went into that game with two academy props on the bench, and you saw one of them coming on and had a really tough time in the scrum, got driven up into the air and backwards. So look, it probably, that image probably summed up the Munster's deficiencies on the day. They're in a really sticky spot, Marie. They're down in 12th in the URC. There's obviously plenty of time to turn this around. But I think it's been a continuation of their poor run of form towards the end of last season as well. You think back to the URC playoffs, the quarterfinal win over the Ospreys in Thomond Park. They weren't that convincing, and they were very poor then in the semi-final defeat to Glasgow. So it's kind of continued on this season. They've lost 4 out of 6 games. You look at the two wins that they've had, they, Connacht probably should have beaten them earlier this season, and beating the Ospreys down in Cork a few weeks ago. The Ospreys were missing lots of players, and they're a really poor side as well. So Graham Rowntree has a bit of a job on his hands, to put it lightly, but I was writing about this today. 2 years ago, in his first season in charge, he had lost 5 of his opening 7 games, which kind of gets forgotten about because obviously Munster went on to win the URC that season. And a turning point that year was beating South Africa 15 down in Porquíquive. Mm-hmm. Listeners will probably remember that. So it's probably just as well that an All Blacks 15 are coming to town this weekend to play Munster in Thomond Park. Now, I'm sure lots of people would prefer Munster not to have a game just so they can get some fit bodies back. But look, it's a pretty strong All Blacks side that are going to be playing in Limerick. But if Munster were to pull off another one of their famous victories over touring sides, hopefully that could be the turning point that they need for the season as well.
Stephen Ferris is with us as well. Stephen, do you think that Munster have the playing personnel they need to turn things around and try and achieve something this season?
I've said it for the last couple of weeks. I do feel sorry for Munster, and it's just because of, they have been very unlucky with the amount of injuries that they've had this season. Personnel, we've seen it in the media over the last couple of weeks. Graham Rowntree trying to go out and get a prop, an emergency prop, or a couple of players has been banded around to be brought in. And, you know, it's not easy when your backs are against the wall and all of a sudden you're in South Africa and you're playing a Sharks team that is absolutely fully loaded. They're off the back of a good win against Glasgow and they're trying to make a statement of intent in the league. And, you know, Munster were there for the taking. I thought they were a lot better the week before and had numerous opportunities against the Stormers in the first half specifically, but weren't able to take them. And even against Leinster, they were pretty good, made a number of line breaks, but just didn't have that killer instinct. And I think that just comes with confidence. And, you know, you're missing a number of the players that have been ever-present for Munster over the last few seasons and do add a bit of bulk and do add a bit of power. And you lose RG Snyman, who's now playing the rugby of his life for Leinster. It is pretty difficult to swallow, isn't it? So, like, I think this Munster team will come good. They came good a couple of years ago. They're a team with a lot of quality. They've got a good head coach. They've got a lot of experience in the squad. And, yeah, like they're not a team that's just going to continue to lose games and get worse. And if I was a Munster fan, I would continue to have faith in what is there, and hopefully it comes good.
Stephen, how frustrated were you watching Ulster throw away a 3-try lead against Cardiff?
Oh, geez, I didn't think you were going to ask me that one, Marie. I was trying to avoid that. That's why I was speaking so long about Munster there. Yeah, I was there in the Cardiff Arms Park and 19-0 up at half-time. Ulster in absolute cruise control. Nathan Doak looked like he had been back to his form from probably his first season when he got a run for Ulster, keeping Cooney on the bench, and he was unbelievable. Jude Postlewaite in the centre was fantastic. McCluskey was playing pretty well. All the young guys were really good. Izichukwu, who might get a chance this Autumn Internationals, was very good in the back row. And then they come out in the second half, and it's amazing. It's amazing, just, you know, a professional sport. A moment happens, and I think it's Ewan Stevens scores in the corner. Superman dive gets in, and the atmosphere, honestly, it just changed immediately. The Cardiff supporters were like, hold on a second. We're 2 scores away here from, you know, getting ahead of Ulster, and it was just a penalty, a couple of knock-ons, a couple of poor kick chases, and before they knew it, they were under the pump and under the sticks with their head in their hands going, geez, in 30-odd minutes here, we've managed to go behind. And fair play to Callum Sheedy. Like, it was a difficult kick to put them 2 points ahead with the conversion, but I think over the course of the game, you have to give it to Cardiff. They showed so much belief and character in that second half, and not in one bit did Ulster roll over. They just didn't come out in the second half, and they couldn't get a foothold in the game, and that's what Richie Murphy has to figure out. They've so many young players, and he keeps saying about, you know, how his job is to make Ulster better. Well, he's got to make them better, but he's also got to make them be able to manage games better, with their kicking game and pinning teams back when you have them under pressure. And they just were in a little bit of shock once it got really, really tight, and unfortunately they come out of the wrong end of the result, which was hugely, hugely disappointing after that first half.
Yeah, very much so. For Leinster, though, they did beat the Lions keen, but it wasn't maybe as comprehensive as the victories that we've seen from them of late. But everybody's talking about Sam Prendergast and his performance and how good he is, how much potential he has. Is there a ceiling, maybe?
I still think he has a bit to go. I'd fully expect him to get capped for Ireland in November, probably in that Fiji game, maybe off the bench if you'd imagine Kieran Frawley probably needs to start a game as well. But he did well. I thought he started very well. He brings lovely shape to the Leinster attack. And when you have a pack that's on the front foot, that's obviously very helpful. But something that Leo Cullen was touching on afterwards was that, look, it wasn't just down to Sam Prendergast, but Leinster lost a little bit of control over that game, and maybe he didn't quite. Stephen is talking there about, you know, Ulster learning to kick the ball and put teams back, pin them back into corner, keep them under pressure. That's probably something that he needs to learn a little bit. But look, it's definitely very exciting. You've seen the amount of time that Ireland have invested in him. He started all three games on the recent emerging Ireland tour as well. So he was part of the group that linked up with the squad today. And look, I think it'd be great for him that another 63 minutes under his belt. He started the first season, but he does have a way to go, I think, yet before being anything like the complete 10.
Stephen, Connacht were impressive. 31-7 win over the Dragons.
Yeah, it was good to see. Needed a response. It's just part of me that thinks this Connacht team are on an upward trajectory, and then, you know, they go a couple of defeats. You know, that first half, was it against the Sharks? They were just dreadful, and then all of a sudden, a bit like Cardiff there at the weekend, they got a score and back they came, and they come up to Belfast, run the wrong end of a result there. It just feels like they're a little bit hit and miss. I feel that they do concede too many points, and that was probably a big positive to come out of the weekend, was that, you know, they kept the scoreboard a lot lower this weekend than they have done previously. And they're always a match for any team that travels down to the sports ground, and they show huge physicality down there, try to play with lots of tempo, lots of pace. Caelan Blade, you know, back playing very well. It's just one of those up and down seasons so far. I know it's really early on in the season, so that they're going to hope to improve, and Pete Wilkins and the rest of the coaching group will absolutely back themselves that, you know, Connacht can get into that top 8 spot. But as we've seen so far in this league, especially with the likes of the Lions, who just missed out last year, they're a really stubborn side at the minute and can score a lot of points in very quick succession, and as they showed in that first half against Edinburgh a couple of weeks ago. So it's a brilliant competitive league at the minute, and hopefully Connacht can they'll get another couple of results after the international window.
Stephen, thank you so much for all of that. Cian, thank you as well. One last bit of news to bring you. Bray have beaten UCD 2-1 on aggregate, and they're going to face Athlone in the SSE Airtricity Men's First Division playoff final at Dalymount this Saturday, and the winner of that game will then face Drogheda.